Let's go through some of the biggest stories of the NBA drafts, including some stuff that's happened since. Ace Bailey, is he ever going to show up in Utah? Masai Ujiri gets fired the morning after the NBA draft. We go through some of our favorite picks, some of those intriguing picks, and a bunch else right now with me and Tom Havistrow. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. NBA draft, it's over. And to discuss it all, to recap it all, Tom Havistrow, what's up?
Kev, just so happy to be here on draft week. Just very, very, just very grateful that we're able to do this on draft night. Thanks so much.
Lot of emotions this week in the NBA draft. A lot of great reactions, people tearing up and realizing their dreams. And then you see Ace Bailey wearing a Utah Jazz hat, pouting, just not happy. He didn't want to go to Utah, it seems. Jonathan Givony over at Draft Express reported that he told at least one team in the top five that he did not want to play for them. And then Brian Windhorst over at ESPN followed up with a bunch of reports about how he doesn't think the Angels, Danny Ainge and Austin Ainge, are going to back down from the fact. Ace Bailey, so on Thursday, the day after the first round of the draft, Walter Clayton, their other first-round pick, flew out to Utah. Ace Bailey did not. Windhorst said again this morning, now it's Friday morning, that this is not a crisis yet. That's what Windhorst said. He said that's what the Jazz are projecting out right now. But it could be, if he doesn't come to Utah over the weekend, because they're starting their summer league training camp on Monday. Tom, I liked Utah's draft on paper. Ace Bailey, a big swing. Walter Clayton with the 18th pick in the first round, a swing. A guard who can get buckets. Clutch, we saw him win the national championship. And then John Tanjay, 24-year-old wing, bucket getter. I liked what they did in the draft. But if Ace Bailey is going to make this difficult, what a start to his NBA career here, man. What do you make of this, Tom? What do you make of this whole situation for Utah and Ace Bailey?
I think the Utah journalists are trying to figure out who is representing Ace Bailey. Where is he getting his advice here to start his career, where he becomes a top five NBA pick and then is seemingly trying to strong arm Danny Ainge and his son, a Danny Ainge who built a championship roster. And with this Utah team, it's not a great fit in terms of the style of play. Will Hardy is one of those coaches who really believes in Missoula ball, or the same sort of, three and D mindset, where she's like, fire up threes, abandon the mid range, take high efficiency shots. And that's not Ace Bailey's game, but they feel like they can mold this guy into a player that can be an all-star one day, a big swing, like you said. But are you sure that he's getting the right counsel or the right advice? Are we even sure that his agent is even certified by the MBPA? Because it seems like, for me, what I'm reading from reports, Ace Bailey is coming into this pre-draft process with not the most typical or traditional representation giving him his best advice. It doesn't seem like this is going well.
So his agent, air quotes when I say that, is Omar Cooper. Omar Cooper is the father of Sharif Cooper, a player that went to Auburn. Sharif Cooper was suspended for about half of his freshman year at Auburn because his father represented him and the NCAA did not approve of this relationship with a family member agent. Now, Cooper is also not NBPA certified, so he is representing Ace Bailey, but he is not certified by the MBPA, okay? So we're in a situation here where Ace Bailey is getting his advice from Omar Cooper, not a certified agent, giving him bad advice, poor planning throughout all of this process as well, not working out for teams, canceling on the Sixers, just horribly mismanaged by Omar Cooper. And for Ace Bailey, I think there's two ways to look at this. One, he's a kid and he made a tough choice. Everybody can see it except for him, right? Like, it's just like kids make poor choices. But also, like, you're going to be a professional. And I think it does speak poorly on sometimes your choices. Like, you have to take agency in your life. Like, you are 19 years old. it's your choice to choose this guy who isn't a certified agent, who, let's just be honest, like, there's no signs that this guy is a trustworthy agent, a talented agent. There's no track record. And for a player who's projected at the top five pick, for things to be handled this way, I mean, come on, your alarm bell's got to be going off for Ace Bailey right now. They have to be going off. Like, wait a minute. Did I just make a poor choice here? I think I need to correct this. Like, your alarm bells have to be going off.
Yes.
Okay? Like, at this point, they have to be. Have to be. And so, for Ace Bailey, I think it's foolish if he does not go to Utah and play out this situation with the Jazz, because you're getting drafted to a situation that is stable, with ownership and front office and head coach. Will Hardy is a very talented young head coach. The Angels in that front office, very tight with ownership. Ryan Smith, this is not a front office, a coaching staff that I think is going to be overhauled in a year or 2 years. This is a stable place for you to grow, with a lot of other good young talent on the team for you to grow aside. Walter Clayton included, John Tonjay included. Never mind the guys that are already on that roster right now. A Taylor Hendricks type, like Lauri Markkanen more established at this point. But Isaiah Collier, a good playmaking guard who had a great rookie season. This is a good basketball situation. So if Ace Bailey is, you know, honest when he's like, I'm just focused on basketball. He was asked this week at his media day thing, did you see this, Tom, where he's like, why didn't you work out for the Sixers? And his answer was, I'm just focused on basketball. Are you kidding me?
What?
Like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And if this is his agent speaking through him, like, dude, you got to realize you made a mistake. Change your representation. Find someone legit, somebody proven who can help you make the right choices in your career and steer you right instead of whatever the hell's going on here. Because not only did they really negatively impact him financially, falling from 3 to 5 or even possibly further like he wanted to, you're in a situation now where you might be ruining the entire start of your career. Because who knows? He might show up. He might be on a flight right now as we speak. That's possible. But he also might not show up on Monday and make this ugly, considering the Givony report that he told teams he wouldn't report if they drafted him. We don't know which team that was. We do not know yet, or if it were multiple teams. But it's very possible he could become a holdout. And to me, that is stupid. It is stupid to do that when Utah is a great situation for him to grow in his career and get over some of his weaknesses that he does have. That he has weaknesses.
Kev, who does he think he is? Like, he's a guy who was on a losing team this year, didn't make the NCAA tournament. He shot 69% from the free throw line, 34% from three. He's billed as a great scorer and jump shooter, but the projections statistically don't pan out nearly as highly as he thinks he is. And I said this last week when we were on the show together. The way that his statistical profile projects at the next level, it doesn't scream like a guy who can really strong arm his way and bully teams into doing what he wants and capitulating to his demands. It reminds me, like Kristaps Porzingis, agents, when they go into the draft, they can have some power in trying to dissuade teams from taking them. Like Kristaps Porzingis, famously, the medicals and the workouts, all that, tried to force his way into a particular situation. It didn't work out for Kristaps Porzingis, and then he became an all-star in New York. Like, I think that's the method that he has to take. Ace Bailey is like, look, we failed in trying to bully our way to getting to a particular destination, but at the end of the day, he has to be a professional. And I'll remind you of this, Kev. Every day that he looks like a malcontent or unprofessional is another day that another team will be like, you know what? I don't think so. I was interested in Ace Bailey before, but the way that he's handled this situation, I don't know if I want to bring him into our team culture. So he's not doing himself any favors by trying to force his way into another situation or getting to his team of destination, because I can bet you that that team that is acquiring him is probably looking at this situation and saying, I'm getting second thoughts about this kid.
I think in the end, he ends up in Utah. I'd just be surprised if the Angels went any other way. I'd just be surprised if they folded here, if they traded Ace Bailey, unless it were for a significant haul. Like, unless it's for a massive haul. I can't imagine them trading for Ace Bailey. And as you said, Tom, you're right. If you're these other teams, you're like, oh, wait a minute here. Are we sure we want to deal with this? Right? Are we sure about that? And I mean, everything I heard prior to the draft is that Ace Bailey is a good kid. That his teammates like being around him. He's fun in the locker room. Guys enjoy being on bus rides with him. Like, people, like, teammates like Ace Bailey as a kid, someone to be around. But everything that I heard prior to the draft is that it's the people around him that teams were worried about. And so for Utah, I think they're banking that their culture that they have, their stability that they have from an organizational alignment standpoint, which is critical for Ace Bailey. They're banking that can set him on the right path and make him realize all his talents. And I hope to God Ace Bailey sees it that way. Because drafted him, I was happy for Ace Bailey. I was like, oh my God, this might be the best possible situation for him. And then they go and get Walter Clayton. And then they go and get John Tonjay. And you look at this team that has a ton of picks and a good coach and a lot of good young talent and a great front office. And you're like, oh my God, like, Ace Bailey at 5, like, it's possible. You look back and it's, how did Ace Bailey fall to 5? Like, that's possible. And so I hope for him he ends up going there, and we'll see what happens, man. We'll see.
Did you see what Jeff Peterson said in Charlotte after they picked Con Knipple and, like, had the press conference? He said, we weren't totally comfortable trading back because we weren't sure we were going to get our guy in Con Knipple. So what does that mean? Picking the tea leaves here,
I didn't realize he actually said that publicly. They had talks with the Wizards at 6. I didn't know he said that publicly. Wow.
So Utah at 5, you'd imagine that maybe Ace Bailey was number 4 on their board or number 3, and that they were happy to take Ace Bailey. But you can see that that Con Knipple could have been there at 5, and do the Utah Jazz take him, who's a much better 3-point shooter, more proven 3-point shooter, and a guy who was part of a very winning program at Duke. And so Jeff Peterson was basically saying, was like, we had talks, of course, lots of talks this time of year about, you know, trading back, but we really wanted our guy, and they got their guy. And I wonder, Utah, where Ace Bailey was on their board, and considering all the reports about the lack of interviews or the lack of discussion and face-to-face contact with Ace Bailey, I wonder if Utah was like, you know what, at the end of the day, high risk, high reward move in getting Ace Bailey, but the red carpet is there for him in Utah. Like, you look at that wing position in Utah, Lauri Markkanen could be the 4, and then you got Walker Kessler at the 5, but they need a guy who can go and attack and score on the wing, and that could be Ace Bailey. And so I'm with you. This was a great situation for him to realize that potential, and it seems like at the moment, he seems to be wasting that even before he steps on the floor.
He's going to fire Omar Cooper and hire a real agent, period. End of story. That's what Ace Bailey's going to do. The alarm bells are going off. Just listen to him. We also got some other news. We'll talk a lot about a bunch of the team-specific picks, player, team matches later. But first, we got to get to this crazy news, because the day after the draft, the Toronto Raptors fire Masai Ujiri, who, of course, has been there over a decade at this point, won a championship in 2019 after taking a big risk, trading for Kawhi Leonard. They win the title. Masai Ujiri, if you're a listener of this podcast, if you've read my mock drafts over the last few months, I have consistently said that Masai is under pressure to turn this thing around. And while I didn't expect him to get fired the day after the draft, he had 1 year left on his contract. So for this to happen today is crazy timing, Tom. I like what they did in the drafts. They got Colin Murray-Boyles out of South Carolina with a 9th pick, a versatile, hard-nosed defender. Reminds me of, like, Draymond Green on defense, Julius Randle on offense. And they got Elijah Martin with a 39th pick, tone setter, part of that Florida Gators national title team, one of the best athletes in the draft, two guys that are defense-oriented players. And then Masai's gone. So here's what I didn't say prior when it came to the pressure he's under. My understanding is that Raptors ownership, MLSE, they felt like Masai was stretched too thin with Basketball Without Borders, his nonprofit Giants of Africa, Raptors ownership felt like the time he was investing there was growing and it was detracting from his role as running the Raptors franchise, their team itself. And whether that's fair or not, that's the way certain members in that ownership group, MLSE, felt about Masai Ujiri. I just think it shows a lot of dysfunction for him to actually be fired the morning after the draft. To me, that says something more about ownership and less about Masai Ujiri, who has a long, very high-level track record going back to when he was in Denver, never mind all his years with Toronto. So I think it's weird, Tom. What are your initial thoughts on the Raptors firing Masai?
He had a year left on his deal, so this is the firing. Straight up. Like they pushed him out because they wanted a new voice in that locker room. Well, Bobby Webster has been running a lot of the basketball operations already as one of the most empowered general managers as you'll find in the NBA. But he had another year left on his deal. He just acquired Brandon Ingram at the trade deadline, a guy who did not play because of an ankle injury since December 7th, and then re-signed him to a contract extension with a lot of that trade package was from the Pascal Siakam deal. So think about that. He makes a big trade, a big swing for an injured 27-year-old Brandon Ingram, gives him a big contract extension, and then a couple months later, after his postseason in April, his exit interview press conference, 2 months later, he's out. And so the organization seemed to have no rudder going forward. Are you trying to win now or are you trying to build around Scottie Barnes, a different timeline than Pascal Siakam and Brandon Ingram for that matter? And then Emmanuel Quickley, RJ Barrett, Brandon Ingram, they haven't even played together yet. And yet you still make that big contract extension because you have to justify the Pascal Siakam trade, which, by the way, at the time of the deal, the Pascal Siakam trade I wrote about last year and saying this was a horrible trade. Think about the three first round picks that they got in that deal for Pascal Siakam and Bruce Brown. The three first round picks were late firsts from Indiana, and then they trade one of them to the New Orleans Pelicans for Brandon Ingram. And then Indiana gets that trade back, that 2026 first round pick. That's not a great return for an all-NBA, all-star caliber player, Pascal Siakam, who is up to being a restricted free agent. And they got what I deemed a very poor return for Pascal Siakam. None of those picks were valuable. And even though you can put on the billboard three first-round picks, they were late first, almost guaranteed to be late first. And so to me, what this says is that as a leader, Masai Ujiri lost his way. Because what I saw in Pascal Siakam's finals press conference, when he said, I lost the joy, I wrote this down because I wanted to make sure I had it right. He said, I'm so glad that the Indiana Pacers traded for me. And quote, it was dark for me, not fun at all playing basketball. He found his joy for the game and I lost that for a while. He's talking about Toronto Raptors after winning a championship in 2019 under Masai Ujiri's leadership. I'm talking about a guy that Masai Ujiri in that postseason press conference, he said, I didn't even enjoy the 2019 NBA championship because his run-in with police when he was trying to go on the floor to celebrate, understandably. But also he said, every moment of that celebration was me talking about how am I going to recite Kawhi Leonard? And so this joyless kind of this culture that he set where Pascal Siakam, who was a homegrown talent, is saying, I was darn near depressed in Toronto and he was so happy to get out of there. This didn't seem like an organization that was built around positivity and joy. And you're hearing from Masai Ujiri at the end of this season. You're hearing Pascal Siakam. You're seeing that Kawhi Leonard left after winning a championship. You're seeing that Serge Ibaka, Fred VanVleet, Danny Green, Marc Gasol all left, walked in free agency. And in the Pascal Siakam and Kyle Lowry, and I guess you could throw in OG Anunoby in there, the returns on those trades, you can see, even though OG was not part of the 2019 championship, you can see how the post-championship regime or the post-championship chapter of the Toronto Raptors was really poor and worse yet, a really poor workplace, as you can hear from Pascal Siakam.
I think with Masai, the Van Vliet one was bad. That was a really rough one for him. So I think with Van Vliet walking, the Pascal Siakam situation, as you said, being a big one, a lot of mistakes by Masai Ujiri in recent years. And so that's why I think, you know, ownership is probably right about certain things with his performance in recent years, ever since the championship. But ownership firing him the day after draft is just strange. And so Bobby Webster, I'm sure he'll probably move into that role, seems to be a highly intelligent front office guy. We'll see how that plays out. But I like what they did in the draft, whether it was Bobby Webster or Masai Ujiri or somebody else.
Well, Bobby Webster did the, he did the, Kev, real quick, he did the post-game about the draft press conference too.
Yes.
So it's not like Masai Ujiri is answering questions about Colin Murray-Boyles. It's Bobby Webster and has been the last few years, him answering questions about the draft because he is the GM and it's not Masai.
We'll be right back. Another guy who talked after the draft was Joe Dumars, because he was asked about his decision to trade the 23rd pick with an unprotected 2026 first from the Bucks or the Pelicans to move up 10 spots and get Derek Queen. It was their second lottery pick. They drafted Jeremiah Fears, a guard out of Oklahoma, with the seventh pick. Derek Queen, Maryland big man, with the 13th pick. And then in the second round, they got Micah Peavy out of Georgetown with the 40th overall pick. Tom, I want to redo on this Pelicans conversation, because on the night of the draft, all the craziness and the insanity during our live show we did at Yahoo Sports, I didn't realize they gave up an unprotected 2026 first in that moment. I was just fixated on, oh, they traded up and got Queen. And then post-game show had King and Vinny on. We just kind of glossed over it. And the craziness of that night, 12:30 a.m. recording from my pod that night, we didn't hit this as in the way that we need to. And I think there's two ways to look at it. A, the way everybody's looking at it. The Pelicans are nuts. They are dysfunctional. Joe Dumars is driving that franchise into the ground again. He traded the Pacers first away too soon. Halliburton gets hurt. Now that first could be highly valuable. And then he trades an unprotected 2026 first from the Pelicans, who are in the loaded West, or the Bucks, who could trade Giannis still, to move up 10 spots for Derek Queen, who is anything but a certainty to be a success in the NBA, considering his conditioning issues, considering his lack of defense, considering his lack of a jumper. And now you put him in New Orleans, the po' boy capital of the world. Where is, boy, I gain weight every time I go to New Orleans. And Zion gained a lot of weight there too. And for Derek Queen, is not the place to be. Okay, so he gave us up that pick to move up 10 spots. That's one way to look at it. And that's all fair. The other way is, the other way is, do they have something cooking, Tom? Like, do the Pelicans have another move lined up that we don't know about that makes it make sense for them to give up next year's pick? Or am I giving them too much credit for thinking logically to even entertain the possibility that the Pelicans have another move or two coming this offseason that makes them a clear-cut top team in the Western Conference, where you're not concerned about that pick next year and that you're only feeling good about Derek Queen? Could they have something cooking, or is this just them being an incompetent franchise, Joe Dumars still being a horrible general manager? What side do you land on here?
Do you think Joe Dumars thought he was trading for Michael Jordan rather than Jordan Poole? Because, like, that's the only explanation I can come up with. Like, they traded for Jordan Poole days before trading their 26 first round pick, which, let's remind the audience here, the 26 Pelicans pick is also a super pick. It's a super first because they could swap it with Milwaukee, right? They have the ability to say, all right, do we want our pick? Or, you know, Milwaukee, they just became, you know, a 20 win team and we're going to swap that our pick for that one. Like, you have the option. It is maybe the most valuable 2026 pick in the draft. Like, that, the fact that they gave that up just to move 10 picks up after you trade away CJ McCollum. By the way, CJ McCollum, if you're arguing that this team is built to be much better next year in a win now team, you don't trade CJ McCollum. When CJ McCollum was on the Pelicans, They were a 25-win team last year with him on the floor. They were 4-22 without CJ McCollum last year, a 12-win team over 82 games. And then you trade for Jordan Poole, who is coming from an 18-win team that was 15-53 when he was playing. What are you doing? This is nonsensical. The fact that they A, traded for Jordan Poole, and then went ahead and traded their 2026 as if they're going to be great next year. This is, it could be the number one overall pick. Let's just point out that. It could be the number one overall pick that the New Orleans Pelicans just traded away next year. Not saying it's likely, but it could be the number one overall pick. And it reminds me of Neil O'Shea back in, 2011, when he traded Baron Davis to Cleveland for Mo Williams and attached the 2011 unprotected pick to go get Mo Williams because, hey, you know, Mo Williams is an all-star. Got to bring him in. And thank you, Baron Davis, for your leadership over here. I know Blake Griffin loves you, but hey, we don't love the draft in 2011. They're not, why, who cares about, you know, drafting a 19-year-old? That pick turned into Kyrie Irving. It went number one overall. Okay. They didn't think it was going to land number one. Of course, the Dallas Mavericks didn't think they were going to land number one. Let's also remember the 2012 Damian Lillard. That wasn't the Blazers pick. That was actually the Brooklyn pick that they got in a trade for Gerald Wallace. And then they end up with Damian Lillard. 2017, the number three pick the Sixers had because Sacramento, Vlade Divac took over for Sacramento and said, we need to dump all this salary. Carl Landry, Jason Thompson, we need to get rid of this salary because we need to go chase free agents in the offseason. And Sam Hinkie in Philly was like, oh, great. Great. Let's take a pick swap in 16, a pick swap in 17. And Vlade Divac is like, what are the odds that 17 pick swap will really turn into anything? Turned out it turned into Jason Tatum. Okay. The number three pick in the 2017 draft turned into Jason Tatum because with the number three pick and they swapped out, they ended up going and get Markelle Fultz at number one. And of course that pick swap turned into Jason Tatum. Let's talk about 2019 DeAndre Hunter in that pick swap, like the New York, the Lakers, that wasn't the fact that they got number four, went to New Orleans, ended up with Atlanta. That was also a traded pick that ended up being a number four pick. And then last year, Reed Sheppard, the number three pick, that was via Brooklyn going to Houston. So it's like, it's not out of the realm that this future first unprotected that can be swapped with the Milwaukee Bucks ends up being a top four, top five pick. And it could be number one. We have seen it in NBA history, whether it's Kyrie Irving or others with a Jason Tatum trade back in 2017. This is possibly the worst trade of the last decade if that happens, if they end up losing the number one overall pick just because they love Derek Queen.
Especially with the 2026 draft class. Last night, I made a post saying how, you know, as great as the 2025 draft was and as fun as this was, 2026 draft is even more loaded because between Darren Peterson and Cam Boozer and A.J. DiBonta, you have three clear-cut number one pick quality guys, and that's not even factoring in Nate Amendt among, like, a bunch of other guys who could develop a lot over the next year and play into that top three or even into the number one conversation. You cannot rule that out happening over the next year. And people replied saying, well, you draft people do this every year. You always say next year is better. That's not true. That is not true. A year ago in 2025, there was way more uncertainty about some of these guys behind Cooper Flagg. Cooper Flagg was the only certainty. And other than that, it was like Ace Bailey could be great. Dylan Harper could be great, but there's no guarantee about some of these guys as number one pick quality. Next year, there's at least three Cooper Flags. That's what next year is. And so you don't have to get the number one pick to get a guy who can change your franchise next year. And depending on how things develop, there could be even more of them. And so for New Orleans to do this deal is a monumental risk. And for the Hawks to get this pick, it continues a run of this new look Hawks front office nailing it. I like the Porzingis deal for them. Ason Newell at 23. I thought they would take him at 13, and then they get him 10 spots down at 23. Such a massive victory for that new front office to get these guys. Hawks are nailing it. so far. There's a number of other teams, Tom, that I think have some of my favorite draft hauls as well, including the Philadelphia 76ers. They get VJ Edgecombe with the third pick, a wing out of Baylor. And then in the second round on Thursday night, they got Janai Broome out of Auburn. I'm not the highest on Broome, but I think for the Philadelphia 76ers specifically, it's very clear what Daryl Morey in that front office is trying to do. They're trying to hit the short term and the long term, because with Edgecombe in the short term, he can hit spot up threes for you. He can play hard on defense. He can crash the boards as a wing. He fits in perfectly next to Maxey and McCain and Embiid and hopefully a restored Paul George. And then with Janai Broome, there's a chance he's like from day one, the best backup big that Joel Embiid has ever had, because he's older, he's experienced, he's grizzled, he's tough. He rebounds, he boxes out. He's a smart decision maker as a passer. He's a good at-rim finisher. And because Embiid can space the floor from three, you could play two bigs as well. I think that option will be there for Nick Nurse, the Sixers head coach, to play with multiple guys. And so for Philadelphia, Tom, I come away feeling like this is a franchise that is both trying to address short-term needs, but also understanding that VJ Edgecombe in the long term, with his athleticism and raw on-ball scoring talents, could be a long-term piece for your team, regardless of what happens with Joel Embiid, regardless of Paul George, that VJ Edgecombe, Tyrese Maxey, and Jared McCain could be a big three in the backcourt for the Sixers in the long term. So I love what Philly did. What do you think?
Yeah, see, Joe Lacob, when he talked about the two timeline theory with the Golden State Warriors, I don't think he was totally off base. He just had to hit the picks, right? Moody and Kuminga and James Wiseman haven't panned out in the way that they had wanted, and building around their veteran core of Draymond Green, Steph Curry, and Klay Thompson, right? What the Philadelphia 76ers are doing right now is two timeline. Like, Joel Embiid is 31 going on 35. Paul George is 35. And they're trying to build also this timeline around Tyrese Maxey and Jared McCain. And then you got VJ Edgecombe. Like, these two kind of groupings are very much like a decade apart in their development. And so it is interesting that Daryl Morey is trying to thread the needle here. And like you said, build long term and in the short term. And I got to say, I love Hunter Salas pickup too. So not just those two players in the draft. They take Hunter Salas, who was one of the best players in the ACC last year. Go Deeks. And I do think that Hunter Salas is going to give them an option here off the bench this season on a two-way contract, it seems. Wake Forest players, I know I'm biased because I went there, but time and time again, you look at James Johnson, who's still in the NBA, they hit more than any other college program in the NBA, and they've done it again here with Hunter Salas, being able to take him undrafted. I have a high expectation for Hunter Salas at the next level as a great scorer who had a down year from three-point shooting, but absolutely can be a nice a role player at the next level and have a long career, just like Ish Smith, who was undrafted by the Wake Forest Demon Deacons and then ended up being one of the great vets in the NBA. So I think the Philadelphia 76ers are big winners on draft night. I'm totally with you, and I love the Edgecombe pick. Everything about him, I love this guy, and I do think that his skill set fits really nicely next to Tyrese Maxey and Jared McCain. So it is tough. Like, Nick Nurse has a little bit of a tough job here, is that you got Joel Embiid, who is not an up-and-down guy, but they got these athletes and these great scorers and these fast players in Jared McCain and Tyrese Maxey and VJ Edgecombe. And if he threads the needle, this could be a really fun team in Philadelphia next year and going forward.
It's like fire and ice, right? Like, I think that was part of it with the idea of Harden and Maxey. Harden, the guy who moves at a slower pace. Maxey, the speedster. And so now Embiid in the front court, the slower paced guy, and then you can play fast as well. Non-Embiid lineups could be fast paced, and then you slow it down a little bit with Embiid. So I mean, it's big ifs. Big if Joel Embiid stays healthy. Big if Paul George has a bounce back year. But if those things both happen, Philadelphia is very, very intriguing. And like you said, with Hunter Salas, I like that undrafted pickup. They also signed Etan Almansa, who at one point last year was a projected top 10 pick. He did not have a great year for the G League. His stock ended up falling. He went and played in the NBL at Perth. They didn't have the best season there either. So young guy, was formerly a top 10 player in the draft class, has fallen off, but maybe for Philadelphia, he'll figure some things out there. Another team I liked, you know about this team, Tom, the Charlotte Hornets. I loved their draft haul with Con Knipple at the fourth pick, Liam McNeely falling to 29, a UConn wing, didn't shoot the ball well, but he is at the high school level. He was an elite shooter. Sion James out of Duke with the 33rd pick. Ryan Kalkbrenner, a big over 7 feet tall out of Creighton with their 34th pick. All four of these guys in total just make perfect sense when you're building around LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller. They all make sense in the Charles Lee system. To me, like, this is one of the biggest winners of this entire draft class. What does it mean, do you think, for the full picture of the Hornets? Are they suddenly, like, competent at this point?
I'm keeping my third eye open on this one, okay? They really, like every team, wanted that number one overall pick to take Cooper Flagg. Con Knipple, what's the connection to Cooper Flagg? Can you remind
Duke.
Me?
I know exactly where you're going with this, Tom. I know where you're going.
James, what was the connection? Does he have any connection to Duke?
Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Liam McNeely. Is there any connection to Cooper Flagg? I don't know. Is there?
Well, he played at Montverde. They wanted Cooper Flagg. Yeah, Montverde. They also hoped he would be the teammate there. Part of the reason McNeely didn't have the best year is because UConn was thinking they were going to get Cooper Flagg and that McNeely would be able to play his proper role.
Yeah, well, those are three guys who have a relationship with Cooper Flagg. And I gotta say...
Also, Tom, there are a lot of Duke people in Hornets ownership as well.
That's right. So if you don't get Cooper Flagg and things don't work out in Dallas, maybe you build an organization that is just like that lady across the street who's like, you know what? I want to go to that team. And like, I don't hate, just like, put the Cooper Flagg stuff aside. I think like you can look at this, forget the fact that these are all closely connected to the Cooper Flagg. You can see that this is just a home run of a draft night for the Charlotte Hornets. Now, Con Knipple is a guy that at number four, you can see the shooting. You can see the dynamic play offensively. When I went to that ACC tournament game when Cooper Flagg got hurt, and I got a chance to see that Duke offense run by Con Knipple, and also got to see him earlier in the season against Pitt when Cooper Flagg had that incredible, just dominant second half and just destroyed Pitt. This is a great pick, and it's not just because, hey, it's a Duke guy, Duke front office or Duke ownership group, and this is, you know, time and time again, we see the Charlotte Hornets. They do have the most picks in the first round since 1989 to Duke or UNC players. And it's no coincidence the team is in Charlotte. It is a UNC, you know, organization historically. And in Charlotte, there are a lot more Chapel Hill grads and fans than there are Duke. But I think when you're talking about building for the future, I think this has as much to do about building a really strong professional organization that in the previous regime, kind of like, again, in the same way with Masai Ujiri, I think it lost its way with a lot of off-court issues with James Booknight, Miles Bridges. I think this organization is trying to transition into a new era. And I think this was a very smart 2-day draft process with the Charlotte Hornets.
I've been impressed by what Jeff Peterson's done so far there. And I think for them, this helps build a foundation that makes yourself appealing. They still have a lot of draft capital in the years to come as well. And so for Charlotte, they could be one of those teams at some point when the moment's right, go make a big trade. And maybe you set yourself up way down the line for Cooper if things don't go well in Dallas, as you said, with a lot of his former teammates and guys that he's been around a long time. I also loved what the Suns did, Tom. I got to say, at first, when they traded Kevin Durant and they didn't get their future picks back, I was like, Brian Gregory, off to the worst start in history as a general manager. And I cooled off. I became a little bit less emotional. I talked to Gambo, and I get it. I get the approach that they took with KD. I get going for the younger guy in Jalen Green rather than getting, you know, some picks back in the future. I understand. I wish they got their picks back, but I understand the approach. And then their draft night. Come on, Malawach, out of Duke, falls to the 10th pick. They trade up to the first pick in the second round. They get Rashear Fleming who is a really good 3-and-D style guy. And then with the 11th pick in the second round, they get Kobe Brea out of Kentucky, who's one of the best shooters in the entire draft class. I'm not just like standstill shooter, a shooter who can come off of screens, who can hit sidestep three-pointers as well. So you get Maluach, a big, Fleming, and Brea. The Suns, to me, are suddenly looking fun. They feel fun. They feel like a really good, exciting young team to build around with Devin Booker. And if I'm Book, I went from saying to myself, well, maybe I should look around and look elsewhere, to suddenly I'm looking at my Phoenix roster and I'm like, okay, we could be something with this crew. We could be something. Like, we could be a competitive team, and we get a lot of guys that can get better over the course of time. So I've completely changed my tune with the Suns, and they're starting to, once again, Tom, look like the bright future Suns. That's what they're starting to look like again after these horrible years. They're still going to get rid of Bradley Beal, but I'm seeing the light. I'm seeing the light, Tom, with the Suns. I'm seeing the light. It's not out completely yet. There's still some clouds, but it's getting brighter.
Yeah. Hats off to them for resisting the urge to draft Jace Richardson, the Michigan State product, son of Jason Richardson at number 10. Just, I want to give him a round of applause, because after you go out and bring in Tom Izzo's longtime assistant as your GM, you bring in Jordan Ott, a Michigan State grad, as your head coach. I thought it was signed, sealed, and delivered that Jace Richardson, the Spartan, was going to go to them at number 10. But they resist that temptation, and they get Maluach, who's a project. He's a guy who I think can step in and give you some really good minutes at the center position, a position of need. I really like Kamon Maluach. I got to see him, like I told you earlier, I got a couple games watching Duke, being a North Carolina guy. But the next two picks, I really like them too. It's not just about Maluach, like you said. And remember, there was a guy, Devin Booker was his name, that he came off the bench for Kentucky, a good three-point shooter that tended to be much better at the next level. And I think there's a lot of potential there for Brea as well, is just a guy who's going to – Kentucky guys time and time again. I know it's not Calipari anymore, but time and time again, Kentucky guys. I talked about Wake Forest earlier. The other program that continues to exceed expectations in the next level is Kentucky. Kentucky Wildcats, before Calipari, after Calipari. There's something in the water there in Lexington, Kentucky. They do great in the NBA. They are born to perform at the next level. And so I like that pick. It is also kind of weird. They traded for Mark Williams. So Nick Richards and Mark Williams, and then a Duke guy, they really liked Charlotte Hornets center position last year, that they got both of those dudes in trade. So I think this is really interesting that the Phoenix Suns have loaded up at the center position and done a good job on draft night in ways that I didn't have faith, like you. I didn't have faith on draft night that they were going to make the right call, but they absolutely did.
Yeah, they absolutely did. And I think there are a number of other teams I liked as well that I'd give an A or A plus to. The Pistons getting Chaz Lanier with the 37th pick and the Mike Kemp draft guide. I compared him to Malik Beasley. Only makes sense they get another guy who can shoot like Beasley did. Grizzlies trading up and getting Cedric Coward, Small, and Mayshak in the second round. Two really hard-nosed, gritty guards. And then Coward, to me, going to end up possibly the steal of the draft, getting him trading up aggressively for the 11th pick. I had Coward 7th on my board. It would not surprise me if Zach Kleiman, an analytics-driven general manager, had Coward rated even higher. And then the Lakers trading up and getting a Adu Thiero in the second round. Thiero's got everything except a jumper. Everything. He's one of the most ferocious dunkers in college basketball, an elite, versatile defender, tough, hard-nosed guy. He's like a bigger version of Lou Dort when Lou Dort came out of college, where he had everything except the jumper. And Thiero is an even better athlete. So for the Lakers to get him, if they can fix that jumper, he's going to be in the league for 10, 15 years. And we'll be right back after this break. Biggest surprise in the second round, Tom, the Pacers. We see them lose in the NBA Finals, Tyrese Haliburton out for all of next season. They draft Cam Jones out of Marquette with the 38th pick. You know, that's a good quality pick, Cam Jones. He can handle the ball. He can play without the ball. He ran point last year for Marquette after Tyler Kolek went off to the NBA after being drafted by the Knicks. And then with the 55th pick, they drafted a guy that ESPN had no footage to play of. Like, Sam Vecenie over at The Athletic did not have him in his top 100. I didn't have him in my top 70 here at Yahoo. I don't think I saw Taylen Peter listed on any draft board. No ceilings. I don't think they had him. I don't think anybody had Taylen Peter with the 55th pick from Liberty. Taylen Peter, Tom, fascinating here. I had not scouted him. I had not watched film of him. But last night and this morning, I watched some. The dude is a shooter. 44.9% of his threes he made last season off the catch. And it's like not just standstills. It's off of movement. It's sprinting, stopping on a dime and transition. And he made 44.9% of them. And he also had 32 dunks on the season. Explosive in space, mostly off of cuts, attacking closeouts. But at 6'4", 6'5", he's a bit explosive. He's a knockdown shooter. He came off the bench for Liberty. And he gets drafted in the NBA in the second round. For him to even declare for the draft, it's like, huh? Really? I don't know this for sure, but I wonder if he had a promise from the Pacers and if he knew he'd go there and if their scouting staff targeted him as a major, major sleeper and promised him. As the graphic on screen says, he had a 72.4 true shooting percentage, which led the entire nation last year. So Taylen Peter, I didn't scout him entering last night. He wasn't on my list of guys to dive into. But boy, oh boy, I give the Pacers an A-plus for the creativity. And I think for Indiana, man, especially, you know, a more well-known guy in Cam Jones and then drafting Taylen Peter, no Haliburton next year, but I hope it ends up a fun year in Indiana, Tom. I hope Nembhard has a big year. I hope Nesmith has a big year. I hope they're able to be competitive, and I hope these two rookies end up shining for them as well. It'll be so cool, especially with Taylen Peter had a big career.
All right, your guess. Better Liberty shooter, is it Seth Curry or Taylen Peter after watching the tape?
I mean, you're always
going to Seth Curry went undrafted.
Undrafted, I know, you're always going to choose
Seth Curry.
Always going to take a Curry. I'm always going to take a Curry. But Taylen Peter is a damn good dude.
If he's anything like Seth Curry, who went undrafted and has now finished up his 12th year in the NBA, things will be okay. So Seth Curry, also one of the great misses in the draft, is just like, how did teams not realize that Steph Curry's little brother can also shoot too? And so I think the Indiana Pacers are like, yeah, you know what? We're not gonna make the same mistake here out of a Liberty shooter. And Seth Curry transferred over to Duke, obviously. But that's a really cool story. I didn't see that happening, and neither did all of the draft experts. So Indiana, I'm not second guessing them. Like, for sure, after they built a team one win away from the NBA Finals, where you and I both didn't see that nearly as confidently as they did in their ability to build a title contender. So now they have their own pick next year. They have no incentive to tank. And so this is going to be a fun season, I think, for Indiana. A little surprised that Nembhard, teammate of Andrew Nembhard, brother of Andrew Nembhard, didn't get drafted on draft night. And so I'm excited to see what the Nembhards do next year. But yeah, did you see that Andrew Nembhard's brother? I was a little surprised that he wasn't drafted too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think with a number of these guys, like I think Hunter Salas, it's probably the case where he asks to go undrafted, tells teams not to draft him because if he knows where he's going to go. And I'd imagine it was the same thing for Ryan Nembhard. It is surprising the Pacers didn't take him, you know, pair up the Nembhards next season. But at the same time, I get it. I get that they wouldn't want a more traditional point guard like Ryan Nembhard in their system, where it's about fast movement, moving the ball, cutting and all stuff like that. And you take Taylen Peter over Nembhard, who ended up signing with the Dallas Mavericks. We'll talk about the Mavericks a little bit later. But real quick, the Thunder, the champs, Thomas Sorber. I talked about him on my pod on Wednesday and on the live show. I love that pick for them. And then in the second round, they took Brooks Barnheiser out of Northwestern. This is not a guy I had in my top 70. I did watch Barnheiser. I didn't have him in my top 70 because he does everything except shoot. He's a hustler, 6'5". He played a bit of point last year for Northwestern. He's a good connective piece, plays hard on defense, sets a tone, but I didn't have him in my top 70 because of his shooting. Made only 25% of his catch and shoot threes as a senior, doesn't have the best mechanics, shot only 31% from three over his entire four-year college career. And so the question with him is he ever going to figure out his shot? He's a 78% guy from the free-throw line, so there's some good indicators for him, but the shot from the field never got better. Well, if you told me the Thunder were going to draft him with Chip England, the best shot doctor in the world, then yes, I would have ranked Brooks Barnheiser in my top 70. I think this is a good example, Tom, of how situation, opportunity, coaching staff, team track record of developmental success plays such a pivotal role in the success and failure of prospects. And so for Sorber, he goes to a place he doesn't have to be pressured right away to play. Barnheiser goes to a place where he can develop his shot with the best shot doctor in the world and Chip England. And so for the Thunder, they come away, as they do almost every year, one of the big, big winners of the entire draft class. What do you think about them taking a big in Sorber? Does that make sense? If you look at what was missing, if there's anything missing from them winning the championship, was it another backup big in Sorber?
Well, I think it makes Isaiah Hartenstein that much more expendable in a couple years if they wanted to use his contract to go acquire a big-time star. So Isaiah Hartenstein, at his number, again, they signed him to a free agency deal last summer that New York could not compete with. They literally could not offer him that kind of money. And so you're looking at Isaiah Hartenstein that in a couple years, there's going to be a salary crunch. There's going to be a cap crunch for the Thunder when Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren's extensions come due. And then you got Shai Gilgeous-Alexander with his max extension, which might be the most lucrative in the sport. So I think this also has implications to the current roster in the future. And so he's a great shot blocker, a guy with great numbers at Georgetown. But this Brooks Barnheiser dude, he's a guard who averaged 9 rebounds last year for Northwestern and averaged 2.3 steals. Like, what are we talking? This guy is insane. Like, a great defender, all defensive team at Big Ten, and a guard at 6'6" who was averaging 9 rebounds. I need to watch more tape of this dude.
Yeah, so was one of the people I was texting with about him prior to the draft. They're like, dude, you're going to regret not having him in, like, your top 50. That's what they said to me. They're like, you should have him in your top 50. And then he gets drafted in the top 50 by the Thunder. I think this person might have known something, is what I'm trying to say with him going to Oklahoma City. He goes with the 44th pick. And so maybe I will regret not having Barnheiser that high, because he's got everything you want in a high-level role player, especially the boards, the hustle, the tone-setting stuff. It's just the jumper's going to get better. And Oklahoma City is probably the best place for that to happen to him. And, you know, the OKC wins the title. They have a good draft. Teams that are looking to take the next step. Minnesota fascinated me, Tom, because Rudy Gobert was involved in the trade talks involving Kevin Durant. And then in the draft, they go out with the 17th pick. They take Yoan Berenguer, a French center, very raw, with the 17th pick. And then with the 45th pick in the second round, they take Rocco Zagarski, an Australian center. And so they take two international centers, both of them pretty raw, especially Berenguer. And you have Rudy Gobert on the roster making a big bag of money. Julius Randle, a free agent. Naz Reid, a free agent. I shouldn't say Julius Randle has a player option. But with Minnesota, I am fascinated by Tim Conley's approach here. I wonder, is this about for replacing Gobert down the line? Or is this about, let's get these guys in the short term, and then maybe it makes Gobert more expendable if these guys are ahead of schedule? And so that guy over my shoulder with that Gobert jersey, I wonder about his state right now for Minnesota, considering these two draft picks.
Yeah, it's a little awkward, isn't it? Because you're kind of mentoring your replacement here with Rudy Gobert, where he has two more years of guaranteed money at 35 next season in the new extension, where it was basically a lot less money, $35 million next season and $36 million in 26-27, and then a player option for $38 million in 27-28. So theoretically, he could negotiate an extension after the next season, like not this upcoming season, but in 26-27, or these kids will be 2 years down the road, and maybe you feel better about, mm-hmm. you know, moving on from Rudy Gobert or using him in a trade if they come along very quickly. But it seems like a French mutiny waiting to happen, is that Rudy Gobert is like, I want to help you, progress in your NBA career. I'll show you the way. And then Minnesota's like, you did such a good job, we're now moving you to the Phoenix Suns, you know? So it seems a little awkward there. But yeah, also a very interesting night for Minnesota. And like you said, you know, the trade option of trading Rudy Gobert for Phoenix Suns, but Anthony Edwards is not, you know, openly campaigning for Kevin Durant to come there. But they make a really good draft night with these two guys. And I do think that Rudy Gobert, he's kind of the best case scenario for these guys, right? And so they have a lot to learn from Gobert.
Some other teams that I was very intrigued by what they did. Magic, Jace Richardson, you mentioned him earlier, Tom, as a Michigan State guy. They get him, talked about him on the podcast on Wednesday. I love the fit with Orlando, smaller guard surrounded by a bunch of length and versatility in Orlando. Noah Pender, they trade up in the second round with Boston to get him with the 32nd pick. Does everything you want, except shoot. And so for Magic fans, he's going to be a love him or hate him guy. I think they'll probably love him as long as he becomes a competent spot up shooter. The Nets using all five of their first, which we discussed on the Wednesday night pod, surprising that they did it the way they did it, that they took all those international guards as well. The Warriors trading down from 41 to 52 and 56. They got Alex Toohey, an Australian forward. Interesting fit for them. He's a good connective piece. He's a good defender, but he's not a good shooter. He needs to get better there. And then Will Richard from Florida. I do like that fit there. The Wizards, Trey Johnson, Will Riley, Jameer Watkins. Like, it continues a trend with size and versatility. And so you have Chris Middleton and CJ McCollum now with a bunch of talented young guys. I like the Wizards are building, but the one that interested me the most is the Blazers. They drafted Yang Hansen with the 16th pick in the NBA draft. This was a big time shocker to people around the league. I got a bunch of texts about this where people are like, Yang Hansen at the 16th pick. Could they have traded down and gotten him? Maybe, but maybe not. Tom, you're a Blazers guy. What are you hearing about this? What's the logic behind pairing Yang Hansen with now Donovan Clingan, who had a great rookie season? Are they just going to play jumbo, twin towers, two bigs? What's going on here in Portland?
Oh, let's go. Let's go. I am so here for this because we got four centers on that roster. You got DeAndre Ayton, you got Donovan Clingan, you got Rob Williams III, and you got Duop Reith already. And then they bring in this kid who I watched the film, and Jake Fisher over at Steinline tweeting out that he heard from a Denver coach, a Nuggets coach, texted him saying, this is Chinese Jokic. And you watch the film and you see the resemblance. I'm not saying he's going to be a three-time MVP and a champion for the Blazers, but I'm saying there's a lot of Jokic in his game. And he has said that he models his game after Alperen Şengün, Domantas Sabonis, son of Arvydas Sabonis, Blazers legend, and Nikola Jokic. So the fact is, this guy is a big who played at the combine and showed a lot of these skills. He's a young prospect that is going to probably take a couple years to figure out the speed of the NBA. But as a shot blocker and a passer, the passing analytics that we have from his time at the CBA, which, by the way, the MVP of the CBA was Jared Sullinger. So we have to keep things in perspective about the numbers that we're seeing in that level of competition. But he's a passing big And in this NBA, you need skilled bigs. And this is what you want from the Portland Trail Blazers with Donovan Clingan, Rob Williams III, and DeAndre Ayton. You want as much skill at that position as you can. And it looks like he is loaded with skill at the offensively. Defensively is where I think he has the most room for improvement. But in terms of like 16th pick and home run swings, you know, this is where Giannis Antetokounmpo was picked, right? Around this position. You can still make big, high-risk, high-reward or high-reward swings here in the back half of the first round. And they certainly did that with Yang Hansen.
It's fascinating, Tom, from so many different angles. Because, the Chinese Jokic thing, is he Chinese Jokic, like, bootleg Chinese NBA jerseys and NFL jerseys with, like, you know, with the bubbly numbers on the back? Or is he Chinese Jokic, like, he's going to become one of the steals of the draft? That's what we're going to find out in the years to come, because everything you said is true. And what he did at the NBA draft combine just a couple weeks ago, a month ago, he showed up and he survived on defense. He was a great rim protector in China, a great rebounder in China, and I thought he looked solid defending in the scrimmages at the NBA draft combine. His passing, the connective passing, showed up for him with his ability to deliver the ball accurately with velocity. And on the post, he's not just, again, like, the level of competition was not great in China. As you said, Sellinger, I love Sellinger, was the MVP. He's got post moves, man, and not just like his primary post moves. He's got secondary post moves as well. He can react to the defense as well. He's got good feel. And so for Portland, it's fascinating from that perspective. But from a team building perspective, you invested in Clingan in the lottery last year. You already have Ayton on your roster, Robert Williams on your roster, and now you have Yang Hansen as well. I'd imagine, A, DA and Time Lord, you're on the chopping block. They are very open to trades. I would imagine that is not sourced. I would just imagine that that is the case for Portland. But also, B, it shows the importance of bigs in today's NBA. The league is getting bigger. You need to have the ability to go to two bigs. You got to have the ability to play with one big. And having both Clingan and now Yang Hansen, I do think it puts them in a position now to have that flexibility in the years to come, especially if one or both of them can develop at least a solid three-pointer, 33, 34% off the catch. I'm not asking for a lot here. And both of these guys have shown the willingness to shoot threes. Yang Hansen only made 28% of his threes last year, but he made 67% of his free throws, has touch on post-ups. Maybe there's something there for him in the long term to be a guy who can at least space in certain two big situations. So for Portland, I just look forward to seeing what they do from here, Tom. It's going to be very, 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 very interesting with them. At the top of the draft, Cooper Flagg goes number one, of course. Dylan Harper goes number two. We talked a lot about that on Wednesday, but I did want to get your thoughts on this, Tom, because Flagg, BetMGM released their Rookie of the Year odds. Flagg is minus 225. Trey Johnson was second at plus 700. Ace Bailey was third at plus 800. That might have to change. And then Dylan Harper was fourth, 13 to 1 odds, plus 1300. Are those odds too low, you think, for Harper to win Rookie of the Year, especially compared to Cooper Flagg being the heavier favorite that he is? What do you think?
Well, it's a matter of opportunity for Dylan Harper, right? Like, it's not a matter of talent. I think talent-wise, playing next to Wemby, Dylan Harper could be the favorite for Rookie of the Year. It's just a matter of the logjam they have at that position with Stephon Castle and De'Aaron Fox. So, to me, I'm not as surprised at that rank. I probably have him at shorter odds compared to Ace Bailey and what we've seen the last couple days. But I am a big fan of Dylan Harper. And I like Carter Bryant, too. I think the San Antonio Spurs hit a home run on draft night. I really love the fit, the 3-and-D aspect, the really big wing in Carter Bryant, just 19 years old, out of Arizona. I love the long-term fit with Wemby. And, of course, Dylan Harper, one of these second-gen prospects that continually exceed expectations at the next level. I'm a big fan of Dylan Harper's future, but I understand why the odds are so long on him, given that he's got to carve out time with De'Aaron Fox and, of course, Stephon Castle ahead of him. And that's really what this is about, right? Rookie of the Year It's about opportunity. It's about touches. It's about scoring. And Dylan Harper, I think it's going to be in shorter supply than some of those other guys. And Cooper Flagg, man, I think the talent, obviously the talent to win Rookie of the Year next year. Again, though, opportunity is playing at the three next to AD and Gafford and Derek Lively. Is it going to be as fluid of a transition in the NBA as you would expect in other scenarios? If you was at Washington or at Utah or at Charlotte, I think those odds would be at like minus 400 if he was in those positions.
I agree with you there. I think that's true. He's the favorite, but not like an over the top favorite. You can still gamble on some of those other guys and maybe feel like they got a shot considering that Dallas situation. The Mavericks are interesting here because, you know, you get Nico Harrison coming out at his press conference and he's like, fortune favors the bold. Nico has, you know, you're shaking your head. You're Tom Havisham is just shaking his head just vehemently right now. But like Nico,
no.
I mean, look, you got to be feeling good. You get Cooper Flagg. You get the number one pick. You sign Ryan Nemhard, an undrafted free agent as well. That I'd feel really good about getting Ryan Nemhard as a guy who can help fill the empty shoes of Kyrie Irving to start the season. They'll, of course, in all likelihood, sign a veteran point guard as well. But for the Mavericks, I asked the same question to Vincent Goodwill and King McClure on my pod on Wednesday night, Tom. I want to ask it to you as well. I said to them, if Anthony Davis stays healthy, and if Kyrie Irving returns and stays healthy, and if Cooper Flagg is the clear-cut rookie of the year, are the Dallas Mavericks a championship contender?
Yes, yes. If Kyrie Irving is playing like Kyrie Irving and Anthony Davis is playing like finals MVP candidate Anthony Davis in 2020, and then you got Cooper Flagg, who's to me, by my eye, like this guy is 18 years old. He's a year and a half older than what KG was in his rookie year coming out of high school. I think there's a lot of similarities between their games, KG and Cooper Flagg, just the ability to right away make a high impact. I think he is going to be a plus player right out of the gate for the Dallas Mavericks. But your conditions there, your hypothetical is more about Kyrie Irving and Anthony Davis than it is to me about Cooper Flagg. Like, this team does have the pieces to make a run next year, but it's a loaded Western Conference, man. It's going to be tough. But if you're telling me that Klay Thompson, Kyrie Irving, and Anthony Davis are healthy and playing like their name suggests they can, yeah, they're a title contender, but that's a lot of ifs. And I know Nico Harrison can sing to the heavens about fortune favors the bold, but what you're describing here is like winning the Cooper Flagg lottery. It's like, I just don't see the odds of that happening, given the track record of their injuries. I mean, that's what's so problematic about trading away Luka Doncic for Anthony Davis, is just like, you can't build around these guys and expect them to be healthy for the next 4 years. And sure enough, you see that. Not that anyone could have predicted Kyrie Irving tearing his ACL at the second half of the last season. But, you know, when you talk about the talent, it's there. And Cooper Flagg is as talented as they come when it comes to 18-year-olds entering the NBA.
Oh, I mean, I'm rooting for Mavericks fans to get one over. I hope those Dallas fans that feel like they're lost, I hope Cooper Flagg is so great that they're like, okay, I'm back in despite everything. Because those Mavericks fans are amazing. One of the best fan bases in basketball. And I hope Cooper is so great they're won back to that team. Tom, I'm sure we missed a bunch of stuff. There's a 59 picks, bunch of undrafted guys. We have a long offseason ahead, summer league right around the corner. I'm very excited to be in Vegas for some of those games and see a lot of these guys play with their teams for the first time, except for maybe Ace Bailey. We'll see what happens there. Tom, thanks for joining me, man. We'll be back again soon, man. Have a good day, Tom.
You got it, Kev.
Big thank you to Tom Havisham for joining me on today's episode. Thanks to Mike and Emmy and the whole team for producing it. Thanks to you for giving us a listen and for enjoying all of our NBA draft content. The live show on Wednesday was awesome. Did the pod after that as well. That was a lot of fun. And this was too. Always love NBA draft time. I'm going to get started on 2026 right away. This is the year we're going to get started with the NBA draft stuff earlier and all throughout the entire season, because 2026 is, I'm telling you, I think it's the best draft class that I have covered in my years covering this since 2013. It is the best up top. I can't wait to see how it develops. So stay tuned for all of that in the coming months as well. Have a good rest of your day. We'll be back again next week.